Welcome to Nightlife, the first hour.
When the race began last year for a medical solution to the deadly COVID-19 virus, researchers around the world launched a truly impressive array of clinical trials. In Australia alone, there were an unprecedented number of trials launched at almost unprecedented speed too, according to an article published in the Medical Journal of Australia in May. Some of the trials were focused on coming up with ways to prevent the deadly virus, such as vaccines and nasal sprays. Even more were focused on coming up with treatments for COVID. So what's actually involved in running a clinical trial? How do you run them anyway? Who runs them? Where do you find all the people to go in the trial? Who funds them? And what kind of rules are there for clinical trials? Are they the same the world over? If companies, we've conducted a trial in Venezuela, are they the same rules as conducting a trial in Victoria, for example? What kind of benefits can they lead to for you and me? Well, walk through it all, and we've got some amazing medical minds with us. Joining us on the program tonight, Professor Meg Jardine's been involved in many, many clinical trials during the course of her career. She's currently the director of the National Health and Medical Research Council's Clinical Trials Centre at the University of Sydney. Meg, good evening to you. Welcome to Nightlife.
Thanks very much.
Great to have you with us. Professor Elizabeth De Summers, Chief Executive of Medicines Australia. That's the peak body representing the drug companies that develop and manufacture prescription medicines, biotherapeutic products and vaccines. Medicines Australia also plays a key role in working with governments on policies and regulations covering clinical trials. Elizabeth, good evening to you and welcome back to Nightlife.
Thanks, Philip. And just a correction, not Professor. That would be nice. But,
well,
not such a lofty title.
So. Well, yes, I know. We'll award you a Nightlife honorary degree for the moment. That's right. And finally, Karen Van Gorp, who is going to reveal to you exactly what it's like being a patient on a clinical trial. Karen, good evening to you as well.
Good evening, Phil. Thank you very much.
No, welcome to all three of you. Meg, can we start with you? Why do we run clinical trials anyway? What's their main purpose? I mean, haven't we worked out whether the drug's any good in the lab?
Well, no, we haven't. And that's why we need to run trials. We run trials because fundamentally we want to improve human health. And human health is complex. It's a mix of our genetics, our environment, our lifestyle, other diseases we may have and other treatments. And that is so complex that often when we try and guess what the effects will be, we're wrong. So we need to do the trials to make sure we understand firstly that things work and also importantly to understand if they're causing any harms. And then we know the best way to use those agents.
Yeah, I've always been puzzled by it when you read reports of new drug development. You say, look, it seems to be very efficacious in mice or pigs or whatever. But then you have this writer, it's never been tested on humans. And you think, yes, by the time you get to administer it to a human, how much of a leap of, well, I wouldn't say a leap of faith, surely. How much of a leap of science are we making here?
Well, in fact, mice are not completely dissimilar. There's quite a lot of similarities in the DNA of mice, but the way mice live is completely different to the way people live.
Tell me about it.
You have to test, first of all, in those preclinical animal models, but then you do need to test in people, and you need to do that cautiously. And that's why we have all the phases, the phase 1, 2, 3, and 4. You start very cautiously with a very small number of participants with low doses and short exposures. If everything goes well, then you move on to the next stage so that you're just learning more and more about the drug and its safety before you expose too many people to it.
Yeah. Okay, so what? So you know after testing it on, I suppose, how do we know that it's not going to cause humans significant damage if we've never tried it on someone? We don't, do we?
Well, yeah, you're talking about the first exposure in humans.
Yeah.
So what's required before you do that is that you've done very extensive animal testing and that you, there are things like having to expose the animals to very high levels, far higher than you'd use in a human,
right,
to try and get as much information. We can get other indications of how it's likely to work from knowing how the molecule works and from similarities with other agents, but you never completely can be confident that you know everything, and that's why you need that cautious start.
Yes. It's not, I was just reading about it, it's not just drugs that are tested in clinical trials, is it, too? There are other kinds of things are put to the test, too. I mean, there have been some very interesting trials in what's the best way, for example, to clamp an umbilical cord, haven't they?
Yes. Yes, yeah, absolutely. You know, anything should be tested until we've got good evidence, and that's procedures, devices, physiotherapy, psychotherapy, everything. So that trial you're talking about was conducted in premature babies and seeing what the effects were if you delayed clamping the umbilical cord for just 1 minute. And what happens when you're delayed is that you actually save lives and you reduce the requirement for blood transfusions in those babies. So huge effect, global implications, because that's something that can be done anywhere. But we wouldn't have known that without having conducted the trial.
Yeah. Yeah, there's an interesting one on breast cancer too. It used to be common to have all the lymph nodes in the armpit cleaned out. That led to a lot of discomfort for patients after breast cancer surgery, restricted their movement. But then they did a clinical trial finding it was more effective to remove just the first node.
Well, that it made no difference, yes. And that was another trial conducted by the Clinical Trial Centre. And they're really important studies, Phil, those studies where we test practices. So that one was, as you say, it was because we used to clear all the lymph nodes out of the armpit, and there was a similar trial in patients with melanoma. Again, we used to clear all the nodes that were near the melanoma. And the breast cancer idea came from patients. You know, patients were reporting all the discomfort afterwards that lasted for years and asked if it was truly necessary. And that led to the conduct of the trial. And the trial showed that there was no difference in survival. The patients who only had one node taken out did just as well, but they were a lot better off in terms of complications and comfort.
Mm. Yeah, interestingly, you discover all sorts of things when you're researching stories like this. Not all drugs that we have today have had to go through clinical trials, have they? Yeah. It's only really since the 1980s that we've actually run these as a must do thing.
Yeah, absolutely, and that's one of the challenges with some of the old drugs in practice. Yeah. They're long out of their patent. No one's interested in funding these trials from an industry perspective. But we don't always know if they're the right drug for which patients and if the dosing is right and the way we use them is right. So there's a huge need for trials that come from the clinical community. And those trials are funded by government or universities, but they're terribly important.
Okay, so you couldn't sell a drug in Australia unless it's been through a clinical trial, could you?
Yeah, that's right. But that's true of drugs. It's not true for devices and other procedures. But right. For drugs to be licensed, they need to have met a certain standard of evidence. And in fact, we are finding benefits we didn't expect because of that. You know, in 2008, just a little over a decade ago, the US FDA started requiring that all diabetes drugs be tested to make sure that they were at least safe for cardiovascular events. And that led to a huge suite of trials that tested that question, sponsored by industry. And what we've found out is that some of those drugs have benefits for the heart and benefits for the kidney, even in people without diabetes. Mm. And we'd never have known that if those trials hadn't been done.
Mm. Yeah, it's interesting, isn't it? Elizabeth, how many clinical trials get carried out in Australia each year?
Thanks, Philip. It's actually a growing number of clinical trials, but there's still quite a small proportion compared to the number of clinical trials that are done around the world. So I'm looking at some data that was recently produced by the Medical Technology and Pharmaceutical Growth Centre, which is a government body. And in 2015, there were around 1,360 clinical trials started. And by 2019, that had climbed up to 1,880. So it is growing and had grown by around 7% in those 4 years. However, it is something that is such an important part of our healthcare system as well as our economy that we could grow that a lot more. We could do a lot more clinical trials in Australia if we thought about it.
Yeah, unless you think that all trials are conducted by, modern-day big medical capitalists, trying to sell drugs. Not so. Apparently, only about one third of trials are industry sponsored. I mean, two thirds of them are what's known as public good trials funded by government and universities. Is that right?
I think it also depends on the phases of the trial that you're talking about, because as Meg was saying, there's phases one and two are sort of early phase, small scale studies that are done much earlier in the development phase of a drug. And therefore, they are often conducted by the private research institutions or the universities or the, you know, the researchers who are actually making these really promising discoveries. Mm-hmm. But in order to actually build and do clinical trials at scale and treat the numbers of patients required for the later phases, which requires multiple centres and thousands, tens of thousands of patients at times, it needs a really strong capital investment, and governments and universities wouldn't be able to afford to conduct phase three trials without some capital injection from those pharmaceutical companies that they have that investment strategy.
Mm. Tell me about these phases. I mean, we read about them. We've all become experts in phase one, phase two, phase three trials, haven't we? Because we've been sort of watching the vaccines develop. What are these phases?
Well, phase one is, and Meg said this before, where you first test a new intervention into a small group of people, and they are usually healthy volunteers. And so you select people who are generally young, fit and healthy without any illnesses or other comorbidities, other things that might make them not metabolize drugs very well. You make sure that they're clean in terms of they're not taking any caffeine or other medications that might interrupt. And you give a very small amount of the new medication, perhaps only a single dose or a couple of days of doses. And you take blood samples and urine tests and all sorts of measurements to see how that drug affects a healthy person. And you can determine from that how it is absorbed into the body, how it is metabolized by the body, and how it is distributed around the body and how it's excreted. And those tests tell us what are the effects it's having on a healthy person. And that helps you determine the safety parameters for the next studies, where you may give different doses or a longer treatment regime.
Mm. And
that's phase one.
Phase two,
you're giving larger groups of people, and you might be giving different doses to find which is the optimal dose to get.
Typically, give us some numbers here. Well, in phase one, how many people are we talking? I mean, roughly.
Phase one, you might have as few as 20, as many as 100.
Right.
Phase two, you would probably have a few hundred across the country or across the sites. Mm-hmm. And that's really to look at further elements of safety and metabolism and distribution, but also to see if it's creating the treatment effect that you're trying to create. So what does it change in the body that might actually modify the illness? And then phase three, you're actually selecting the patients who are going to benefit from the treatment and comparing the new treatment with either a placebo or the currently accepted standard of care.
Oh, okay. So in phase three, we're actually giving it to people who are sick, for example.
People who need their disease treated.
Yeah.
And that's when you get into very high standards of ethical conduct and protocol control to ensure that every patient every protocol is reviewed by a research ethics committee, and that the benefits and the risks to patients are taken into account, and making sure that the facilities can give the care that's required to the patients during the treatment, and making sure that all of the parameters for safety and good clinical research practice are undertaken.
Right. What about with vaccines, though? Because after all, you're really testing them on people who aren't sick. You're really hoping they don't get sick. So how does the phase three work there? Or is that simply giving the drug to a very large number of people and seeing whether or not it makes anyone off balance?
By the time you've got to phase three, you should know the dose and any of the safety or other parameters that you'd need to monitor for. So in phase one and phase two, you're learning that. By phase three, you know the right dose to give in the right amounts, in the right phases, and whether it's one vaccine and then a second dose 4 weeks later or 6 weeks later or 8 weeks later.
Mm-hmm.
In phase three, you need, if, of a vaccine trial, what you're trying to do is determine whether people who are exposed to the virus will get sick. So those have to be conducted in areas where there is a lot of prevalent virus around. So that's why we saw a lot of clinical trials for the vaccines being done in those countries that were suffering most from COVID.
Okay.
Because you can't ethically deliberately expose someone to a virus.
No, I was going to say.
And see how they go, because that would be.
You can't give you can't give 200 people the vaccine and then inject them with the virus to see whether or not.
I don't think that would pass anyone's pub test. Mm. So you do have to conduct those studies in areas, which was why Australia was not the country of choice to do COVID vaccine trials.
Because no one here was catching COVID.
No one here was catching COVID.
How many make it through, Meg? I mean, I heard one of the reasons the drugs are expensive, et cetera, is because all this testing and phase trialing we're talking about presumably costs millions. But surprisingly, few drugs seem to get through. Give us some indication of those numbers.
Yeah, look, it does cost a lot, and it costs a lot because of all that care and that monitoring that Liz was talking about. Look, the estimates are that overall, from starting from phase one, the chance of a drug getting to market is 1 in 14.
Wow.
By the time it gets to phase three, it's got a 2 out of 3 chance of getting to market. Now, that 1 in 14 for a phase one might seem low, but really what we want as a community, and in fact what pharmaceutical companies want as investors, is they want a drug to either succeed or to fail early. You know, the sort of worst outcome for everyone is if something lingers on and fails in phase three, by then you've invested all your resources into something that's not actually going to make a difference.
It's a large amount. So all this investment in something that's got a 6.5% chance of success.
Philip, Megan, Philip, that's actually once it gets to phase one, but there are thousands of molecules that are in those early discovery phases in the laboratory or in the preclinical or in the animal testing that don't get to phase one as well. So there's also, you know, quite a large investment, whether it's from universities, public trials or pharmaceutical industry trials that fall over before they even get to phase one. Mm. And so there's some estimates that you might investigate as many as 10,000 molecules to get one drug to a patient that actually makes a difference.
Wow. How many is the Clinical Trial Centre at Sydney University running, Meg, at the moment?
We'd run 70 to 90 at any one time. We'd start
70 to 90 trials at any one time?
Mm, that's for our group.
How many people are required to run all that?
400. Mm. Our group has about 250 staff. Okay. That's people who are directly employed by us, mm-hmm. But we also partner a lot with various oncology groups and other groups in the community. So there's many more people involved than just our group in all the hospitals and the sites. Yeah, there's a huge number of people that are necessary to complete these trials.
Yeah, I mean, there's a lot been written, I mean, to both of you, Elizabeth and Meg. I mean, there's been a lot written about the pace at which the various COVID-19 vaccines were developed in the past year and, you know, some people trying to poo-poo the process because of that. And I've always thought, well, yes, because we got stuck into it. How was it possible to get the clinical trials done so quickly?
Look, I think from my point of view, and Meg, your insights would be really valuable as well, but because there was such a concerted collaborative effort across the globe between researchers, universities, governments and the industry, they set about trying to work out strategies to make it as quick as possible.
Right.
Now, normally when you're making these really big investments, they're sort of high-risk financial investments up front. You would do things sequentially and slowly, and you won't make your next decision to do the next trial until you're sure that the first trials have delivered the results. What the industry decided to do in these particular, and what universities and researchers decided to do in this case, is start those things in parallel. So you started the next phase whilst the first phase was still going on, whether that's clinical, laboratory, you know, animal models. So lots of things were happening in parallel. And what that meant was a lot more financial risk was being taken up front. And had they failed, and for those that did fail, you lost a lot more of your investment because everything failed at once, whereas normally you would do it sequentially. So truncating things so that you did things in parallel, it meant you had the same rigor, you did exactly the same things for the same amount of intensity, but you just did it in a shorter time frame with a higher upfront investment.
Mm. Where do you get everyone from, Meg? Who lines up for this? I mean, who would line up, for example, to take a totally unknown drug and see whether it made you sick or not?
My mum.
Yes, you'd be surprised. Look, it depends on the trial. And, you know, as Liz was explaining, by the time you get to the large phase three or phase four trials, which we haven't talked about yet, by then you really want to be looking for the people who are the people that might eventually benefit. Yeah, right. That's who you're testing. So a lot of the time that's people who have a disease. So we're recruiting from hospital sites or primary care sites. Sometimes it's people who don't have a disease but who are at risk, you know, the prevention trials, yep. And so then you might be recruiting directly from the community. In Australia, most recruitment would be through medical facilities, like primary care sites or hospital sites. And who participates? Look, generally wonderful people. People who participate in trials, you know, are altruistic, and, you know, it's a pleasure to work with them. I find that... people decide to participate, you know, for the greater good. People understand that the particular trial may or may not benefit them directly, but generally they're people who understand their disease and who want to seek better outcomes.
Okay, but in the phase one and two trials, though, this isn't the case, is it? You're really testing this drug on people who don't have any disease. You're just trying to work out what it does to them. What incentive do people have? Well,
in phase one, generally in phase two, phase two trials are conducted in people with the disease.
Right.
In phase one, they're very altruistic people.
Okay.
People who participate in trials, though, generally do better than people who don't, even if they're getting the placebo. Now, which is an interesting thing.
Yes.
Partly, perhaps they're you know, a different group of people to start with. But I think a lot of it might be the extra care you get from participating in a trial. If you're in a trial, you're followed up really closely. You know that the trial and its protocol has been through the eyes of clinicians, the eyes of ethics committees, the eyes of regulators in many cases. And so all the background care in that trial is generally the best evidence-based care.
Hmm. Elizabeth, do you have to pay people?
Well, I was actually just going to say that because I have been involved in some of those phase one trials, and certainly in the phase one centre that I was working alongside some colleagues, they are based in a big teaching hospital. They were looking for young, healthy, fit volunteers. And you have to reasonably compensate people for their time and their contribution and their discomfort. So there is a payment that is paid, but it is assessed based on what is a reasonable compensation for the time that they are giving, for the discomfort that they undergo, and for their you know, travel and staying in a facility for a period of time. So. Yeah. So you do get big teaching hospitals or university attachments. You get a lot of students, particularly students who are interested in healthcare. But also there is the attraction of, you know, staying in a unit for a week with three meals a day and a little bit of pocket money to compensate you for the discomfort.
We're talking about... sorry, Meg, go on.
Sorry, butting in there. I think you put that well, Liz. It's compensation. It's not remuneration.
You'll not end up with a deposit on a Sydney apartment offered to Meg, is what you're saying.
No.
I mean, in fact, that's something ethics committees look at. You know, you're not allowed to put in place an inducement.
No. We're talking about medical and clinical trials of new drugs, new procedures, et cetera, and what the process is. It's fascinating. Elizabeth DeSummer's with us from Medicines Australia. She's the CEO there, and Professor Meg Jardine is with us too, Director of the Clinical Trials Centre at Sydney University, a kidney disease clinician. We've been talking about who gets involved in these trials. Well, Karen Van Gorp's with us too, who got involved with such a trial herself. Karen, you were diagnosed with melanoma in 2011, you'd had surgery, but in 2012, you and your doctors discovered the cancer had spread. You had surgery and radiotherapy and
well, it's a pretty aggressive cancer, melanoma, as we know. That wasn't that successful, but you ended up taking part in a phase 3 clinical trial of a new drug in Melbourne. Tell us what happened.
So 2013 is when I had the major surgery. In fact, the surgery that Meg talked about and you, where I had all the lymph nodes removed from under my right arm, and I had radiotherapy as well. So that was the beginning of 2013. However, neither of those worked, and I was told I was stage 4. I had metastases in distant parts of my body's my body, mainly in my lungs at that stage, but that was spreading very quickly to my bones as well, and I was told I wasn't eligible for the first trial that was available. There was no treatment for melanoma at all at that stage. So trials was really the only thing I could look at. And I didn't have the mutation that the trial drug was targeting, so I wasn't eligible for that trial. Then there was a little bit of confusion in planning for any future trials, as I'd been given some chemotherapy, which excluded me. There was nothing. In August 2013, I could feel the tumours popping up under my skin everywhere, under my scalp, along my arms, all over my body, and the scans were showing the same story inside my body. So I was beginning to feel pain in my chest, breathless when I walked. It was getting very scary. And my boys at the time were 4, 9, and 12. And I could, the worst moment was when my little one said, "Mum, are you going to die?" And I said, "I'm going to do everything I can to make sure that doesn't happen." And I'd be awake at 4 o'clock in the morning. I'd be Googling and I'd be researching to see if there's anything out there in the world that could help me. I'd asked at that stage to be referred to palliative care to set up to support my family. I joined a Melanoma Patients Australia support group because, again, it's with the other patients that you can talk about what treatments might be popping up everywhere. And there weren't many people in the group, and there certainly weren't any left by the time I'd finished treatment, unfortunately. But early one morning I was searching and I found a reference in a financial magazine or a financial article online about a pharmaceutical company's shares that were going through the roof because of a phase 1B trial. And I had a look for the results of the trial, the trial results article, and I decided that was the drug that I needed. And I called the pharmaceutical company.
Yeah. What, directly?
Yep. let's just cut you through had all a that bit other of stuff.
You, Karen Van Gorp, you had a bit of ticker, didn't you?
I was going to do all sorts of things.
You were not going to go gently here, were you? You were
No. We talk about you grit your teeth and you drive through, you steer through this.
So what did they tell? What did they tell you?
Well, they said yes. There is a trial. It hasn't opened yet. It's in Melbourne. And I live in Adelaide. And I said, that's fine. And they said, well, the trial hasn't opened and you will have to get your oncologist to refer you. And I said, okay. So I went back to my oncologist and he said, why would I want to fly to Melbourne? So my new oncologist read the report and had highlighted the parts that I had. And so, yes, he said, yes, you need to be on that trial. He referred me. I was just so lucky. I was so determined. And I was randomised into the open label trial that compared a gold standard. So we haven't talked about that one, the gold standard instead of a placebo. So it's just whatever drug is available at the time. And that happened to be a drug that was newly available on the PBS, but it had less efficacy and greater side effects than the trial drug appeared to have anyway. And then there were two other arms, which were two different doses of the trial drug. And I got randomised to the higher dose and started the trial.
And?
and it worked. I'm a super responder.
Oh, wow, what a story.
Absolutely magnificent.
But this is the thing, Karen, that I find, I don't know what to think about this story, because as you said, you were randomised onto that high dose. I mean, you might not have been.
Absolutely. It was never going to happen.
No.
Philip.
No, okay.
I was quite determined.
Of course it isn't. It's Karen Van Gorp. It's never going to happen. No. But this is the truth of it. I mean, the trial, unfortunately, has to be cruel in a way, doesn't it? Because not everyone's going to get necessarily the dose that's going to work.
Absolutely.
It's a really good question about cancer treatments, because you're giving patients the standard cancer treatment that's available now versus a new treatment. And commonly in cancer trials, if you do not improve or if you deteriorate on the current treatment, they cross you over onto the treatment arm. So it's sort of, so it actually makes your data harder to determine, but it is common that in cancer trials that if you don't start on the trial drug and your condition worsens during the trial, you will then be put onto the trial drug.
Okay. All right. Yes.
And I had the other side of that as well, a gentleman who was on the trial with me, and he wasn't responding to the drug the way I was. He was put on the standard treatment and responded beautifully.
How about that? How about that? Meg, tell me about the placebo effect. Karen mentioned it as well. When it comes to clinical trials, apparently some patients end up benefiting in some way, even if they don't have any drugs at all. What's going on there?
Yeah, sometimes they do, and it can be lots of reasons. It goes back to we don't know everything. Some conditions do improve for no known reason, and if you happen to be in a trial when that happens, or on a new treatment when that happens, you'll assume it's a treatment. And that's why it's so important to have a comparator where you can, so that you can tell what's due to the drug or the device or whatever it is, and what's just random variation. There's some interventions, some conditions, anything to do with behaviour or mood that can be particularly volatile and can be particularly susceptible to the placebo effect. So that comparison is important.
Yeah. Elizabeth, survey companies who are surveying opinions, for example, say that once you get beyond a certain number of people, your results don't improve. In other words, if you interview 2,000 people, you'll get just as much a predictor as if you interview 10,000 people. Sometimes people say, "Oh, this seems like a small sample size." Does the same argument apply with clinical trials, or is it the case that you get better results the more people you administer it to?
Well, I think this is going to be Meg's area of expertise, but it's really about the statistical power of the clinical trial. So, how many patients do you need to follow in order for the effect measure to actually demonstrate the effect of the treatment versus other things? And there are multiple things that are being measured in a clinical trial. So you might be measuring, in Karen's case, where the tumours are and how big they are, but you might also be measuring liver function. In cardiovascular trials, you'll be measuring other markers of your heart health, such as your blood pressure or your cholesterol. So you need to have the statistical power so that the changes in those parameters or those measurements demonstrate that it's actually the drug that's creating the effect.
Yeah, well, Meg, over to you on this one, because, I read in with the phase 3 vaccine trials, they were saying we needed a big, a big study of 30,000 people or more. Do you need them to be that large, or can you make statistically good judgments off 5,000, for example?
Look, it all depends on what you're studying and what the question is.
Right.
In vaccine trials, as we were talking about earlier, you're vaccinating people, and then you're waiting to see if they get disease in the two groups, and then if the people in the vaccination group get less disease than people in the other group. So it really depends on how much of the infection is circulating at the time. If you're doing a trial to try and prevent people getting heart attacks, not everyone is going to get a heart attack. That's so right. You need to have enough people in that you'll be able to tell whether your intervention makes a difference. And so generally you base that on prior knowledge of how common conditions are, so you can work out what's likely to happen in the placebo or the control group.
Mm-hmm.
And you base it a little bit on how strong the effect is. You know, there's some interventions where you expect there might be an improvement of 5%, some it might be an improvement of 30%. And it's much easier to tell that strong effect than a weak effect. But there are times when you really don't know. And we faced this problem with a trial in COVID, Clarity, which was looking at a group of old drugs that mm-hmm. might help patients with COVID. And you know, because we haven't had COVID before, we couldn't base it on prior knowledge. So instead, we've taken the approach of predefining a standard of proof. And we will keep running the trial until we meet that standard, or we show that it's that there's no effect. So that's another new approach to get around the problem when you don't really know what to expect.
Because I'm thinking just on, you know, I'm just thinking it through here now. I mean, it's pretty difficult in a vaccine case because I mean you're basically giving people a drug, a vaccine, and then trying to measure its effects of whether or not it prevents disease. But then you can't really control whether the people were actually exposed to the disease because you say it's unethical to expose them deliberately.
Yes.
So you're kind of hoping in a way that people put themselves in harm's way, aren't you? I mean, in a sense that that's a factor that you really can't control in the trial as to whether people were actually ever exposed to the disease in the first place.
I think I'd put it that you choose to conduct your trial in an area where you know that whether you're there or not, people are being exposed.
Right.
And that's why, you know, one of the reasons the trials were as rapid as they were.
Is this also why they were, I think a number of them were conducted in South America. Is that the reason why? Because these were areas where the virus was more rampant.
Yeah, yeah. And it also means too that for those populations, it's more enticing to be in the trial because of that that threat.
Hmm. If you've got questions, 1-300-800-222. Our guests tonight, Elizabeth De Summer from Medicines Australia, Professor Meg Jardine from Sydney University, Karen Van Gorp's a patient who did her own research and amazingly turned up a trial which has done an awful lot of good. Karen, where are you sitting at the moment in terms of your response to the drugs and the state of play of your own disease?
It appears that I've had what they call a complete metabolic response.
Well,
so I finished treatment in 2015, it has continued to. It hasn't changed from the end of that. Anything that they see in a scan, they say is probably just some sort of scarring.
Mm-hmm.
And a complete response or stable disease. But sometimes we might even be able to use that cure word.
Yes,
we're very, very careful about using
that. We don't do
that
in cancer so much, do we?
No.
No. And probably for good reason. But it's a remarkable story. Let's take a call or two. Mark's on the line. Hi, Mark. G'day, Mark.
G'day, Phil.
Yeah, hi, Mark.
G'day. Phil, I'm participating in a clinical case series for intravenous ketamine infusion for veterans' mental health.
Mm-hmm.
In fact, I have had some discussions with Liz at Parliament House in Canberra. We talked about it briefly over coffee pre the COVID days. But since December 2019, I've had 23 intravenous ketamine infusions to address treatment-resistant major depressive disorder and chronic post-traumatic stress disorder. And it has significantly transformed my life.
Okay, who's conducting this trial, Mark?
It's my psychiatrist is the lead architect.
Okay.
In Canberra. And because ketamine is an anesthetic drug, it's actually being administered in clinical environments through anaesthetists. There's a panel of anaesthetists in Canberra that participated in the process. And I think we're in excess of 100 participants in the clinical case series thus far.
Mm. Yeah, interesting. All right. Thank you, Mark. Sharon in Ballarat, g'day.
Oh, hello. I just wanted to ask your guest about, she'll probably be aware of this, tamoxifen was a drug that was very successful with patients with breast cancer, but unfortunately a side effect was that many people who survived developed uterine cancer. And I have somebody I know who is the has that uterine cancer now after surviving that breast cancer because of tamoxifen, and they're the longest surviving person on a trial of a newer drug that has successfully kept them alive, and partly because of other things, behaviours such as exercising and things like that. Everyone else has died that's been on the trial that had the tamoxifen associated breast uterine cancer.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm wondering if she knows about that.
I don't know, Meg or Elizabeth.
Elizabeth.
Meg, Elizabeth, do you?
I'll answer that. I wasn't aware of the side effect of uterine cancer following tamoxifen, but I do know that tamoxifen is still widely used in breast cancer treatment and now even in prevention of breast cancer for people who have got high risk, the gene predictors of breast cancer. But that, I mean, that is a, you know, obviously if people do have side effects from drugs, it can be quite catastrophic, and that's a terrible story. But I am pleased that I'm hearing you saying that you know the person who's the longest surviving person on a drug, which is a great thing. But I wasn't aware of that uterine cancer side effect.
Oh, yes. Sorry to sort of spring that on you. Sorry.
No, that's all right. But even so, you know, tamoxifen is used widely, but there are lots of, you know, new and emerging treatments for breast cancer, and we're seeing that breast cancer, and Meg will probably be able to comment on this, is one of the far better treated, you know, one of the well-treated cancers, and does have really good outcomes for people. And, you know, I have family members who are survivors of breast cancer, and I think we're just living through an extraordinary time that people are surviving for years and years and years after a diagnosis of cancer.
That's wonderful. Yeah. Mm-hmm. Thank you.
Thanks, Sharon.
Bye.
Bye-bye. Thanks for that. 1-300-800. Yeah. Sorry, go on, Meg.
No, sorry, I was just going to jump in there. Look, I'd agree with everything Liz has said. Overall, tamoxifen is on average, has been shown benefits. It's an unfortunate thing that many drugs will have some side effects. So that's, again, why we conduct trials, so we know if there are more benefits and harms associated. The people with cancer can be susceptible to second cancers, and it's a reason why the long-term outcomes of people with cancer is so important, and that's become a whole area of research in itself, in keeping survivors well, and particularly treating any complications from treatments or from the disease itself that have accrued.
And Philip, can I just comment on Mark's call?
Yeah.
Hello, Mark. I remember meeting you in Parliament House, and it's great to hear that that ketamine infusion trial is still going on and working. I think one of the things that this is pointing to is where a clinical trial to affect clinical practice is being conducted by a clinician rather than a pharmaceutical company. And obviously the psychiatrist in Canberra is going to be exposed to a lot of veterans who have, you know, a lot of post-traumatic stress and other mental health issues after so many years in conflict. And so, you know, that's I don't think we can forget that some of these clinical practice trials rely on clinicians putting themselves out there to run those investigator-led trials, and that's great to hear. So thanks, Mark.
Yes, indeed. 1-300-800-222. Are there ways, do you think, Elizabeth, of making the whole process better and more streamlined?
Well, Australia is a really good destination for clinical trials. We've got, you know, fantastic researchers and scientific bodies and research institutes like Meg's. We've got first world healthcare system and, you know, the best clinicians and physicians in the world. But one of our barriers is the federation, unfortunately. And individual states do a great job of making sure that you can set up clinical trials and initiate clinical trials, have good facilities and recruit patients. But from a pharmaceutical industry perspective, when you're trying to initiate trials in several states around the country, there is a lot of inconsistencies between the states and
territories. Oh, no, you have to get regulatory approval from every state, do you?
Have to get ethics approvals from whether it's public or private, states, different institutional, regulatory and governance requirements. And all of those things delay the start of trials. And so from time to time, Australia misses out or can't give trials to as many patients as possible because they spend too much time setting the whole things up.
Hmm. Yes, here we are, the benefits of our federation, or not.
I just wanted to jump in this and say you're absolutely right, and it can be even at individual site level. The governance procedures, we have to get approval at individual sites, and that can really slow down the start-up of trials. Fortunately, this is an area that people are looking at, and so I think it's going to improve, but it's been a barrier till now.
Hmm. People say that in countries like the UK where the NHS is a highly centralised health system, which we don't really have in Australia, although we've got a first world health system, it's not the same as, say, the NHS. One of the benefits of that is we're getting lots of really first-class, real-time information about the benefits of the COVID vaccines, for example, which, you know, you're not getting in the same way from other markets. Do you think that's right, Meg?
Oh, look, totally. And it's not just their centralised health system. It's that they made a decision to invest in research infrastructure. And so they have a network that covers the UK full of sites and site coordinators ready to run a trial. So if you get a trial approved, the staff are there waiting. And that we saw the results. They activated that system and they conducted the huge recovery trial, which has been, you know, the single most influential trial in COVID in the world. Within a few months, they'd recruited thousands of patients and were able to show that a very old drug, dexamethasone, saved lives. That's something I would really like to see in Australia, that adoption of research integrated into our health systems. And then I think we'd get really efficient at conducting trials and helping participants get access to trials.
Mm. Look, just finally, I don't want to tip you in on this one, but do you either of you have any thoughts on what can only be described as the media hysteria over the AstraZeneca vaccine, Elizabeth?
I think AstraZeneca is one of the members of Medicines Australia. I think that I was really pleased and proud to see that the Oxford University researcher who discovered this vaccine was applauded when she attended Wimbledon in the UK. And I think we should really be applauding the science and scientific endeavour that has gone into developing vaccines. We do know, and as we take more and more medicines and the more we use them, we do know that there are side effects, and it is really important that the quality, safety and monitoring of vaccines continues in the community.
Hmm. Yeah. Meg, did you have any observations to make about it?
I think what's important, Phil, is the dispassionate reporting of benefits and harms.
Yeah.
And so
hear to that.
Yeah. You know, what are your risks if you contract COVID, and what are your risks from the vaccine? And when you balance those up, even in Australia, there is more risk from COVID than from the vaccine. But just reporting those benefits and harms in an unbiased way. And people will come to their own.
Rely on the facts. Yes, exactly. Mm. Look, it's been terrific speaking with all of you. It's as I say, we've all become trial experts and vaccine experts at the moment as we try and come to grips with this pandemic. But I do thank you for your time and expertise, Elizabeth De Summers, the CEO of Medicines Australia, and they of course are a key part of drug development and manufacture here in Australia. Elizabeth, thank you for your time.
Thank you very much for Professor, the opportunity.
Yeah, and you too. Professor Meg Jardine is Director of the Clinical Trial Centre at Sydney University, a kidney disease clinician, and as you heard her say, 250 people working, I imagine, around the clock on literally hundreds of trials as well. Meg, thank you for your time.
Thank you, and lovely speaking with you, Liz and Karen.
Yes, likewise. And Karen, what an inspiring story. Good on you. And terrific to hear you with us tonight and to have your experiences as well. And good luck.
Thank you, Philip.
And good luck.
Thank you.
Thank you, Karen. Karen Van Gorp.
You've been listening to a Nightlife podcast. For more great conversations about the issues that impact you, as well as features on travel and food, head to the Nightlife webpage. You'll find it at abc.net.au/nightlife. You don't need to be a night owl to enjoy the nightlife.